Welcome to Heterodox Americana. This is a show about thinking outside the box and examining the conventional wisdom that informs how we think and shapes how we see the world around us. The question that we're ultimately trying to get at is, how do our unexamined ideas impact our ability to thrive as human beings? And it's our intention to unpack some of these ideas, take a fresh, heterodox perspective that hopefully leads us somewhere new. My name is Raphael Freeman, and I'm one of your hosts.
And I'm Angie Backus, another one of your hosts.
So people are getting vaccinated. How about that?
Yeah, as in people like that you know, or...
I'm just saying it's happening. It's right. A thing. It's rolling out.
Yeah.
Also people that I know and people that I don't know. Wait, that goes without saying. People that I know are doing it. And I also have some people that I know who are absolutely not doing it. Where do you stand on this whole thing?
Oh, I'm a pro-pandemic vaxxer. I think I want people to get it. I got it. I think it'll keep me safe. It'll keep my family safe. And pretty soon I'm going to go back into my office, so.
Are you looking forward to that?
Well, that was one of the things that I think has come up with the vaccination, what it means to turn your life back outside rather than being inside, and how people are working with that these days. I think I have mixed feelings. What about you?
Mixed feelings about going back into your office?
Like you going back out into the world or moving outside of wherever you've stayed isolated.
You know, so I have a personality disorder. I've never said this on the show before, but I have a personality disorder. It's called schizoid personality disorder. Mm-hmm. SPD for short.
Right.
I'm part of like SPD groups, especially on Reddit, but other places on the internet too. My psychologist over 2021 confirmed that I'm at the disorder level. And I gotta say, you know, for people who have SPD, I'm on the rocking it side. Like I'm...
Oh, rocking
it. Yeah, I'm rocking it.
Right.
I mean, for some people, it's crushing, it's detrimental to just their well-being. And for a lot of SPD people, it's not. Like, part of the disorder is not caring. Right? It's like, mm-hmm. It's like, I don't care. And that's true for a lot of people that I talk to. And it's also true for me. Most of the ways, and so it's not quite true. The exception is my relationship with Progeny, but most of the ways that I'm deficient, I don't really care. So here's some real life examples. So people with schizoid personality disorder tend to enjoy just fewer things, and they enjoy things less. And I'm not sure if I've ever said it, you know, on the podcast, or at least in this context, but there are like lots of things that humans find enjoyable that I don't, like live music and concerts, which sort of, you know, I mean, that's almost the same thing. Although there are live music performances that are not concerts, right? So I don't enjoy any of that. Or like flowers or dance, any kind of dance. I don't really like to watch dance, not ballet, not break dancing, not anything, right? And I also don't enjoy dancing that much. Pretty much not at all. I'll do it. But I don't enjoy it. And you know, when I was younger, there was, I didn't realize that there was a reason that people love dance so much. And I was like, this is a waste of time. But turns out that my brain is wired and however it's wired and whatever. I don't want to go on too much about SPD, but in terms of what it means to get back to life as it was, I don't miss it. I don't miss the socialization. I don't miss the people. I don't miss my friends. Actually, I don't miss. Mm-hmm. So here's something about me. I don't miss people ever, right? I don't miss my dead mom. I don't miss people when they're far away. And no, so for me, You know, I don't know if that seems cold, but, you know, it's just how it works for me. There's no element other than, like, decent espresso varieties, which I can't get at home in the same way because I don't have a, you know, $6,000 espresso machine and $1,000 grinder. But if I did, I would say I'm set. You know, there's nothing about the sort of, you know, the outside world that I really miss. There's nothing that I'm eager to run back to. There are lots of people that have contacted me who are like, you know, hey, we should hang out. And I'm like, should we though? I don't have that eagerness at all to get back to anything. I'm completely satisfied and enjoying myself sitting in front of the computer.
Yeah, wow. I guess this could, you know, be a show about SPD.
It could be.
It could be a show about vaccines. It could be a show about what it means for us to emerge back into the world. You know, I think you're on the extreme end of what it has been like for a year of isolation and noting how little you enjoy the outside world. I think you knew this probably, yes, about yourself
before. Yeah, but I had a really good time during quarantine.
Okay.
A really good time.
But, and was the good time because there was no pressure around any of that or expectations?
Oh, no, I just discovered so much about myself and some things about marketing and... you know, I had some big revelations with meditation, that kind of stuff. It was less about pressure and expectation and more about just the fact that I got into a groove that was really groovy and, I just didn't want it to stop. So, yeah.
It sounds like, you know, you've had a good pandemic year.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get lost in this, but you, are you eager to, we started with this, but I didn't get a clear sense as to whether you're eager to get back or.
I'm mixed. I'm having conflict about it. But one of the things that I've been noting is, as I've talked to people, is this is out there. There are people that have discovered that their lives pre-pandemic were kind of on this automatic pilot around their activity. And when that got shut down, I think initially a lot of people felt the loss of that, and it was pretty stark around life before and after the shutdown and quarantine. And now, after it's gone on for a while, I'm talking to people that realize that what they were doing with their life, the way it was structured before quarantine, was this really hurried way of living. And some of them have decided that was kind of an unthoughtful life, that they hadn't really paid attention to what they were doing. They just knew that they needed to do. And after a year of this, it's a lot of people I've noted have been paying attention to, you know, what they really want in terms of activity or social situations, and are confused because they've identified in this really active way for so long.
Right.
And now it's being, they're negotiating or renegotiating and feeling self-conscious about it, feeling a little bit taken by their lack of wanting to, you know, jump back in, and even feel sometimes guilty about not wanting to re-engage all the stuff that they knew. And I would put myself in that camp. I don't think I was ever particularly really busy, but, you know, I think one of the things that I've noted, my life before quarantine was a lot of it, my social engagements were dinner out.
Right.
I live in Philadelphia and there's so many great restaurants here. And I like to explore new food and I like to try new drinks. And I find that that's a really nice way to connect with other people is over food and going out to a nice meal and, or even, you know, a fun meal. And so I spent a ton of time doing that and a lot of money doing that.
Oh, yeah.
And I think when this whole thing shut down, I missed that a lot. And but now I'm finding, you know, relaxation and figuring out meal planning. And I'm also really taken with the amount of money that is not going out every week around buying food out. And it's shifted my thoughts, you know, around how I want to do this going forward.
So it sounds like your mix, I can't call it a mixed strategy, but it sounds like your mixed position has to do with some of that sort of standing social pressure that had to do with how you related to your friends and how you related socially in the world, but also this new discovery of, you know, the things that you can do as alternative, like planning meals and enjoying your time not being out. Is that like a fair sort of assessment of that, how that mix works?
Yeah, I think it's fair. Enjoying my time not being out. That's still, I have to figure that out because I don't want to completely isolate myself anymore. But what I've noted is what I appreciate and where my mind is going lately is having people in my home or going to someone else's home. And I think part of that is because it was just so taken from us that year of nobody gets in anybody else's bubble or pod, as it were. And what it's like to have people step through the threshold of my front door. It feels so nice. And it feels the same when I go to someone else's place. So maybe it's not, you know, the really beautiful restaurants. But I think maybe, you know, thinking of just, you know, fixing a meal and having people for dinner or vice versa.
Introducing some variety.
Yes.
They're the Tony Robbins types out there. Tony Robbins types. So Tony talks about these six human needs, and they are, at least in his formulation, the six human needs that, you know, the way that he puts it, I should say from the get-go, is that what Tony Robbins does is he just adapts something that already came from Maslow. Mm-hmm. So it's really Maslow's hierarchy, mm-hmm. just sort of adapted and made, like, you know, like more digestible. Mm-hmm. But it goes that there are six human needs, and the top two or the first two are both the need for security or stability, and then right after that is the need for variety. Sometimes he frames that in terms of certainty and uncertainty.
Okay.
But one of the things that he notes is that these are, in some ways, they're in contraposition to each other. They're in opposition to each other. That the things that give us variety are different than the things that give us stability. But too much stability, and then we become bored. Too much variety, and then we feel out of control, and then we need more stability again. So it's a tug of war between our need for variety and our need for certainty or stability. The other six, you know, the other four, whatever, that's a different show, but this sort of human need for variety is a real thing, and I certainly get, especially if, like, if anything, even with the sort of global uncertainty of what was happening in the world and what's happening in the economy and what's going to happen to outcomes and sicknesses and deaths and so on and so forth. There's a lot of uncertainty that's happening in that realm. But for so many people in the personal realm, their lives were kind of the same, mm-hmm. day in and day out, and had a lot of certainty of what Tuesday was going to look like because Monday looked the same way and last Friday looked the same way, and, you know. And so, yeah, I get it. I get the desire for that kind of variety to come anew. I was just talking to an old friend who was really looking forward to, he lives in the middle of, I don't know, the plains, right? He's at the middle. So I shouldn't put it this way. In my head, in my East Coast head, in my East Coast brain, everything between California and Pennsylvania is just like one flat plain. I know that Chicago's in the middle. Like, I know that sort of theoretically, but my geography is so, but like, it's just all squares in there.
Oh.
Rectangles.
Okay.
Right? Except Nevada has a weird shape, I think, or Arizona when I'm, anyway, it's mostly rectangles, and then it's like the East Coast and California, and they're like two states north of California, but like, who cares? It's like coffee or something, right? That's my.
I hear you.
That's my map of the United States.
I'm so bad at geography, I'm just listening to you talk about the map, so.
But so he lives in one of these rectangles, and he was like really looking forward.
In a rectangle.
Yeah, he lives in one of the rectangles in the middle.
Got it.
That's and you know, here's what I find too, for the people who live in the middle rectangles, and I know you're out there, and I know you're listening. They know that they live in one of the middle rectangles too.
They,
right?
You think they?
Yeah,
know.
I mean, it's not like they don't know. Like they know, right? So, and they have ideas about the East Coast, and that's some of it's true. The East Coast is kind of harsh.
I just don't know that they know it was a rectangle. I mean, now they do. They can call it a rectangle now. I don't think they were calling it rectangles.
We've all seen the map.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't want to get lost here.
Yeah.
Part of my ADD is I'll get lost anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I enjoy it, right?
Right.
Don't get me talking about hot dogs.
So he's right? Living in that rectangle.
So he lives in a rectangle. And Kansas.
Kansas. Got it. That rectangle.
That particular rectangle. And he was talking all of this to say he was looking forward to going out to a restaurant because he hadn't been out in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And that need for variety is real. that was a long way to say that.
Wow.
I was able to, I think just yesterday, meet up with, you know, an old buddy who's sort of like a linguistic twin of mine. He has lots of linguistic interests that overlap with mine. We actually had a competition once, and he slightly nudged me out, and it made me want to, like, anyway. But a really cool guy is the person who, Jeremiah is his name. He's the person with whom I probably have the most linguistic interest with. And another, I guess acquaintance is probably the better word. Another really good, smart guy that I had met probably close to 18 years ago. We all just got together and talked politics mostly, but also like talked about some spirituality stuff. And that type of variety was good for me, especially, you know, one, because I hadn't been. I mean, we're out in the park, which feels, you know, I like the parks enough, city parks. But we're out in the park and got to talk some politics and just sort of, you know, we're able to ideate kind of off each other. And that was really cool, too. So this is one of the human needs. It's probably diminished for me, that need for variety. But I totally get the impulse of people who are, like, pulling out their hair and they just, like, need, I got to do something different. That's a legit thing. And
so, quickly, I'm just wondering, as this SPD, how was it to, I mean, it sounds like you're talking about it as a positive experience.
You know? Yeah. It was great. The dynamic was really cool in such a way that it's, that type of synergy is relatively rare for me. I think we were sort of politically close to each other, but not quite in the same position. But there were like no ideologues amongst us, right? Like there, you know, I mean, when I say no ideologues, it's like people have a general sense of how I show up, but I'm not all one way, right? I'm not all one way. They weren't all one way. It's the whole nuance thing. And that's always refreshing. You know, it's refreshing amongst two people, but amongst three, you get a sort of synergy that's...
But I was considering you had mentioned, you know, no, like, there's no desire for social interaction. But it sounds like there's an openness when there's this kind of synergy, and that you found that to be engaging after this long year.
Yeah. I mean, I don't miss it, right? And there's certainly not, like, an overwhelming urge. I've been fortunate enough to have a friend group that, you know, if I do acquiesce to the idea of, sure, let's do something social, I can count on my friend group enough to be like, they're going to deliver sort of just like high quality ideas in a way that it's going to be worth my while.
I see. Yeah, I hear that. I think, you know, as we continue to figure this stuff out, well, you're vaccinated, right?
I am.
That's
yeah.
Part of it too. So you felt safe enough to do it.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I would have phrased it that way, but yeah, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I probably met far fewer people. Maybe I met up three times with four, maybe before I was vaccinated. It was outside, 6 feet away the whole time. Mm-hmm. So,
Yeah, it's interesting too, because I think people, I've had people talk about their experience of being in rooms with vaccinated people, because, you know, you can do that now, and what it's like to feel the conflict still, because we've been doing something for a year and we've habituated to something our brains have said dangerous is more than, you know, four people in a room if you're not 6 feet apart with a mask on. So people talk about, have been talking about this too, this idea that even though it's okay, and, you know, the CDC says it's acceptable, the conflict is still happening for people. They find themselves feeling anxious and then realize, oh, that's why I'm anxious, because this is not supposed to be happening, although it is. I was talking to my friend Tremaine a couple days ago in my backyard, and she was talking about that. Like, she's going out into the world, into these places that, you know, now her family's vaccinated, and it's still, she doesn't feel comfortable. She knows that rationally she is, but she has all this anxiety around having done something particular in isolation for so long that now being with people feels a little odd.
That to me makes, part of me wants to blame the basal ganglia. The basal ganglia is this part of the brain that is essentially, it's responsible for like habit building and repetitive, like, you know, sort of various types of memories, right? Mm-hmm. You know, some memories like your ability to remember how to tie a shoe. And then I think that's called procedural memory. Mm-hmm. And then you have your ability to remember like where you left your keys. I don't remember what that's called. I want to say operational, but that's probably not it. At either rate, you know, memory is one of these odd things, but it seems like the basal ganglia, part of your brain, is responsible for the things that you do repetitively, procedural memory, tying your shoes, so on and so forth. And, you know, as we were learning new behaviors and new modalities of how to interact with each other, which took time. I mean, you can remember in the beginning, there was a lot of resistance.
You mean resistance in the beginning of the pandemic?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean. There was a lot of resistance around the masks and social... I mean, we saw it, right? Especially around the social distancing aspects. Lots of resistance, both in the red states and in the blue states. And eventually, we hit some point of equilibrium after we'd been doing it enough that... The flip switch, this became the, you know, for all the people who are like hashtag no new normal, this was like the new normal that emerged, and a new set of behaviors and you know, relatedness, right, you know, between people. And lots of that is just gets stored in the part of your brain where it's like, I'm doing this set of activities over and over and over again. Well, now the guidelines have changed, mm-hmm, and people have a new... some people are like, they can't wait to get back to quote unquote the way things were. Although hashtag RIP the way things were, hashtag RIP, that's never coming back. Not the way we knew it, but that's neither here nor there. My point is your brain having made a new set of mental representations, mm-hmm, about how to relate to one another and to strangers. But that's all. It's going to feel weird now.
Right.
It's going to feel like, I mean, you know, whether you're germaphobe or not, but people feel a little bit creepier than they used to feel, right? Okay. Somebody sits next to you, like, why are you so close?
Right. Well, I still find myself, you know, even if I'm masked and have been this whole year, if I'm outside, like if I'm passing somebody, I move, you know, on the other side of this, not across the street, but I move on the other side of the sidewalk, not because I find them dangerous, it's just to, you know, respect our space.
Right.
At my 15-year-old was, I was telling her that the CDC guidelines have changed now that if she's out with me, I'm vaccinated, she can't be because she's 15, but if she's out with me and we take walks often, she doesn't have to wear a mask. That kid is not going to leave the mask. And so this is the thing, too. Like, right. She is like, you know, I told her, I said, you can take it off. And she said, no, I'm going to keep it on.
The mask feels comfortable now. It was uncomfortable in the beginning. Now it feels like, safety blanket.
What she said, and, you know, 15-year-olds, that's a particular, you know, breed right there. 15-year-olds do these, you know, they're so self-conscious anyway. But she was saying, she told me yesterday, she said, I remember how embarrassed I was to wear it, like when we first started wearing them. She said, I was so embarrassed and I just thought this was such a weird thing. And she said, and now I've switched. Now I'm embarrassed almost to not have it on.
Right.
So she's definitely in her teenage brain has, you know, this makes sense now. And it feels like the way to be outside. And I think for her, it's going to be this very major shift. I mean, we walked around, I didn't have a mask on and she did.
Well, so you weren't even there in solidarity. You were like,
No.
You got your own struggles.
That's right. I mean, you know, I still wear mine enough if I'm going to be in a crowd of people. And I think that's mostly, you know, I'm vaccinated, but I want other people to feel safe. I don't know who's vaccinated out there. So it's a kind of a signal for me to, you know, allow people to feel safe around me. We live on the East Coast. I mean, here, particularly in our neighborhood, in this neighborhood, it's been very masked. There's not really been a lot of issues around whether or not it should be a part of the way people live. It just is. You know, most people in West Philadelphia are walking around with a mask even now. So, you know, I think living here, it's been more of this issue around not wearing the mask than wearing the mask.
It's So, you know, like you talked about the geography of it and, you know, there are a lot of cultural ties that happen to geography and how people sort of experience this, both at sort of like the geographic cultural level, but also like the political stuff that happens to a lot of the people who are in this sort of cultural milieu or geographic milieu who are like, you know, anti-vaxxers or anti-maskers tend to do so less for what we might think of as the traditional political split and more for reasons that have to do with, how could I put it? Sort of conspiracy theory type stuff or conspiracy fears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm an apologist for most, unpopular position, not because I want to be contrarian, but I have this, for me, one of the things that is really crucial to just for myself to understand is that even people who I think are the most irrational probably have some rationale, and they're not nearly as irrational as we think they are. Although, I mean, don't get me wrong, sometimes people are. But a lot of times what's happening is that the information that they're relying on is sometimes fundamentally different than the information that somebody else is relying on, and then they have to like just what gets in, just the inputs are so different, and the inputs are really different now that, you know, I'm a Generation Xer and I'm a little bit too young for the Walter Cronkites of the world. Mm-hmm. I know the name and I sort of know his status and his position, but the Dan Rathers and the, like, people my mom would watch, right? Mm-hmm. Who were crucial in building a set of just like a basis of information that Americans across the political spectrum could rely on, that's largely gone.
Right.
And Facebook doesn't help at all. Right. Mm-hmm. Facebook doesn't help at all. So you know, as we're in our echo chambers, I mean, it's one thing just in terms of, you know, having the same opinions, you know, regurgitated and fed to us. That's one thing that we're all aware of, but I would say just the sheer points of information that we're using and what gets through and then how that gets processed, that's also very, very different for people, you know, geographically and politically. And then you have to make sense of that information in light of all the information that has come before it that you've taken in. Mm-hmm. And given that, I tend to have... sympathy is not the right word, but I tend to be able to see the perspective of people who rely just on like a different data set. I mean, data is not really the right word, but they rely on a different information set in order to build their beliefs, right? So I'm going to tangent and I'm going to come back. You know, for the non-scientists that are out there, which is like most people, you know, I think I know one data scientist, I know a chemist, and I know two biologists, right? So I know four people who are like, they're science. Oh, five, right? There's another data scientist out there as well. No offense to my political scientist friends, because I have political scientist friends as well, lots of them. But that's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
I feel like I'm going to end up backpedaling. But here's where I'm going with this. It's when I look at something like climate science, or even coronavirus science, I know that I don't have the qualifications or even the mental representations to look at those conclusions, to look at those studies. I don't mean like reports on studies. I mean to look at the actual studies and then come to my own conclusions. I'm simply not. I don't have enough information. I don't have enough scaffolding. You know, like it.
So
I don't have the education.
On people that do.
Right, mm-hmm. And so in that regard, it comes down to trust. Mm-hmm. I've decided to trust a set of people, and realistically, these are people that I don't even know. But the question at the end of the day is really about who do we decide to trust, and how do we trust? And you know, I guess for me, it doesn't. It's not necessarily a straightforward answer of whom to trust.
So what do you mean when you say that?
Well, I guess one of the first people that I learned to trust was like my mother, right? I was young. She knew way more about the world than I did. She was able to answer all my questions. I mean, she's like really good at that. And whatever, that's like lots of people. Lots of people trust their parents, right? Because their parents know better, even if their parents are not experts.
Right.
But as we start to grow up, and as we, you know, as the time, by the time we become adults, lots of times our information that we have will outstrip, and you know, especially given, you know, the improvements in education, will outstrip the information that is available to our parents. But that doesn't mean that we trust their opinions less. And on lots of matters, we probably should. Like, you know what I mean? Like, my mom wouldn't have known. Mm-hmm. And so this core question as to how do we know who to listen to, how do we know whom to trust, often that doesn't get its own evaluation. We don't really build a model around how do we know whom to trust. But the place that I land, so if I were to look at, like I said, I have a lot of sympathy for both sympathy and sort of apologetics for the people who are sort of anti-vaccine. Not because I agree with their position, but one, I know that they're building their corpus of information in a different way. But also the lack of trust is, I mean, I think it's justifiable, especially for blacks, right? So if the Tuskegee experiment hadn't happened, do you know the Tuskegee experiment?
Yes. You want to touch on it a bit?
Yeah. So for people, you know, who don't know, I mean, I think this was in Macon. I want to say it's in Macon County, Georgia. But even if it wasn't, here's, it couldn't have been. It was like Tuskegee, right? So Tuskegee, Alabama. There's some geography for you. In Tuskegee, there was a syphilis. They wanted to see what are the long-term effects of syphilis on a given population. And so instead of treating people, even when the first, one of the earlier treatments for syphilis had to, you know, it was based on mercury and had some negative effects because mercury is a heavy metal, but it was a treatment, and the effects of the mercury was less than the effects of long-term syphilis, which always led to death. There was a group in Tuskegee that wanted to study the long-term effects of syphilis on this black population. And instead of treating them either with the first treatment, which was based on mercury, or the second treatment, which was way safer, they did this longitudinal study that allowed people to run the disease to run the course of the people's lives until they died so they could study the effects. And in compensation, I mean, this is not even compensation because the people never agreed. They just were never offered proper medical care. But what they did get for showing up and allowing their and reporting, you know, their symptoms, they got a lunch and they got a pine box burial. That was what they got in return for their involuntary participation. And of course, there are things like Operation Bootstrap that happened in Puerto Rico, and you know, where people were, women were sterilized against their will. There was another sterilization campaign here on the mainland, the United States. So it's not like the medical industry and the United States government doesn't have enough of a record of betrayal and abuse of people who are non-white. Mm-hmm. It's super well established that it's a rampant problem.
Right.
And there's still rampant problems that happen right now as we speak in terms of how medicine treats people who aren't white.
Right.
And so the distrust makes total sense. I get that part. And you can call the people who take that outlook, you could call them conspiracy theorists if you like, but what we have is an actual conspiracy. Like,
right.
People conspire.
Right.
Like, it's a word for a reason. And we have these sort of historical conspiracies that are real,
right,
and that people can point to. And so, you know, what do you do with that? The thing that's a little bit different about where we are now, one has to do with how broad the scope of where we are now, how much transparency there is. And so it's not some little... it's not a little town in Alabama. It's global. It's worldwide. And we can see that the things that are happening in Switzerland, the things that are happening in France, or you know, Thailand and India, for
right.
God's sakes.
Yeah, India's struggling.
That they mirror the things that have happened or are happening here.
Right.
And that should provide some transparency that, you know, people who are prone to distrust to say, well, it's not about us. This is happening everywhere. It looks the same everywhere. Especially if you look at news, and if you don't look at news outside the United States, please just, you know, go to BBC.com, or, you know, if you speak another language, just read the news outside the United States, because you'll see that it's matching, right? It's matching everywhere.
Hmm.
So in this case, it for me, it comes back to this question about whom to trust and how you build that trust. And I think intuitively we all know that if I were to call my brother, let's say, who's not a carpenter, right? Just fill in the blank. If you were to call somebody who's not a carpenter, like, hey, I want to build a frame for my house. And that person was like, oh, I can do it. You'd be like, you're not a carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to let you do it.
Right.
If Lisa down the road, this is just a name that I picked up, but, you know, if she decided that she could treat my wound and she's not a medical professional, I mean, we all have a sense that I'm not going to let you
right.
do whatever hoodoo that you're going to do to my wound to, like, no, I'm not going to
sure.
do that, right? That part is clear. And so whom to trust, I think, at the most fundamental level, we sort of get it, except for when it comes to this part. And I understand the risks that people are weighing. Well, what's going to happen in the long run? And I got to say that as much as you trust a carpenter for your carpentry, and as much as you, you know, whatever, you get the metaphor, it's because of the amount of transparency, because it's happening everywhere, because German doctors, right, like, who don't have any relationship with United States medical distrust whatsoever, because German scientists and German doctors are coming to the same conclusions, I think it makes sense to trust the world on this, you know, the world scientists in this particular regard, even if the scientists in your own country have betrayed you or betrayed your community or betrayed your trust. It's simply not that relationship everywhere, and South Korea and China and, like, everybody's on the same page
right.
with this. And that, for me, is enough to say, hey, even if I can't interpret the data myself, even if I don't know anything about, you know, spike proteins or anything else, it seems like the entirety of the world is moving in this direction, and that for me is trustworthy.
Saying you're pretty so your thought is that this vaccination plan is not a worldwide conspiracy.
I really don't think that it is. And I totally get trust, and it all comes down to trust, whom we trust, and how we're going to build that trust. But in this particular case, I gotta side with the medical institutions in foreign countries that have nothing to do with us and are coming to their own conclusions.
Yeah, I think, you know, what you're saying, it needs to be, you know, it's important that we understand that there have been real issues in non-white communities. And we can't ignore that the people have, you know, they have this history that tells them this could get really tricky. I think also you were talking about what we do when we grow up with a story that we have always kind of taken at face value. It becomes a part of our internal working around how we see the world. And again, you know, giving credence to the truth of all of what has happened in the medical community. But there's also, you know, conspiracies that perhaps we haven't quite unpacked. Like it becomes the story that we've lived with for so long. I'll give you an example. I was talking to my mom this morning, actually. She was talking about how she grew up thinking that cats were cats, the animal cat, you know, a domesticated cat was they weren't likable, and you shouldn't have them, and you certainly shouldn't have them in the house. That was, for her growing up, that was what she was taught. Her dad didn't like them, and she realized that for years and years she had had this adopted belief system that cats were terrible creatures. And honestly, she was talking about, she had just unpacked this not too awful long ago, so it took my mom some time, and she was kind of chuckling about it, but she said, I started thinking, you know, cats aren't really, you know, they're not bad. It was just my dad had told me for years that they were. And so she grew up with this negative bias towards cats until she started unpacking that story and realized that her dislike for the animal was because she had internalized this and had never revisited it.
Right.
And I think, you know, that too is something we can consider if we are leaning in a particular direction in a negative way. Have we really examined the story that we have held, and what is it like to unpack it? You know, maybe you just visit that again.
I think that's really important for any community, black, white, or otherwise here in the States, not to make that binary sort of, you know, analysis of how the United States works, but I think revisiting those old stories and the beliefs that we inherit as adults is, I mean, we talk about this enough, but mm-hmm. that's super critical for moving in into living a way that is truest to who you could be.
Right.
Those voices, there's a thing that I think is really hard, which is listening to your own voice. You know, I think there's a biblical way of phrasing it that sort of seeped into New Age. I think it's biblical, but people call it the still small voice within,
mm-hmm.
or the small still voice within.
Mm-hmm.
But there is an internal voice that we have that guides us enough and tells us, I mean, I think gives us really strong clues as to the direction that we might move in. Not in any kind of mystical or magical way, but just in terms of how our subconscious mind is processing loads of data from the environment, from our preferences, from our bodies, in ways that consciously we're not aware of. There's a voice that is in touch with other parts of our brain processing that doesn't necessarily bubble up to you know, our consciousness. So in that regard, I think that voice has some things to tell us. Doesn't mean that it's always right. But more frequently, I find that there are lots of people, and sometimes you can hear it in the way that they phrase the things that they say, there are lots of people who the dominant voice for them might be their dad's voice, mm-hmm. might be their mom's voice, or mm-hmm. sometimes a teacher or a bully or whatever. And it's crazy to watch someone disentangle that, that still small voice within from all the external voices. Maybe it's their pastor or minister, or what the Catholics call it, like a priest, or someone else who is close, to watch someone disentangle and then hear their voice for the first time.
Right.
In my practice, I've seen it happen at least twice, and both times it's like, oh, tears, right? They got to hear their own voice for the first time. But because we do have a plethora of voices that are constantly informing us, and those voices end up in a loop. They end up forming part of our narrative, the part of our narrative loop. And I think that is hard to break away from, but obviously they inform how we make decisions, our values around things like the medical system, so on and so forth. And right. if we don't examine that thing, then I think even moving into a more authentic, I hate to use the word, but into a more authentic, a more us and less other, informed idea of how we want to show up in the world, that becomes much harder if we don't examine, you know, that core set of inherited values, if you will.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to do unless you're very intentionally, you know, focused on it, unless you're very conscious of it. Like you were saying, you know, your experience with people, when you get to that place where you can say, wait, whose voice was that? And it becomes emotional. I remember the first time I was in therapy years ago, and I was saying something, and she said, whose voice is that? Mm. Who's saying that? You know, because it was just a very, you know, it was a reaction where it's a phrase I had said 1,000 times about myself.
What was the phrase?
Who do you think you are? Mm. and, you know, she said, what voice is that? You know, is that you saying that to yourself? And I got to the place where I was like, oh, yeah, no, I know whose voice this is. So... And I hadn't ever questioned it. It was always, you know, who do you think you are? And that was something I would say to myself.
Right.
So, you know, I think that you have to be aware that you are operating, like you said, you know, we were born and the first person we trust are, you know, our parents, our mom and dad. And then we build, you know, our stories based on what we think about what they've told us. And we have to start to parse that through. So, you know, as we continue to emerge, I call it complicated emergence. It's okay, you know, whatever's going on, if you're feeling a little, you know, it's getting a little bit tricky and you're not quite figuring, you haven't quite figured out how to do this.
Right.
Even with the vaccination, you're still trying to understand how you feel about it. It's okay. We're going to all figure this out eventually. We figured out how to be quarantined. We'll figure out how to not be quarantined. Just be patient with yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a good word. To be patient with yourself, be compassionate with yourself, and wherever you end up is going to be based on the information that is available to you, the belief systems and the trust that you have in place. And I think everybody's going to do, you know, what's best for them given the information that they have and, you know, how they see the world, and that's fine. We don't need to have judgment around that. Whatever equilibrium that we hit in the future that's coming will be the one that we hit. This genie's not going back in the bottle, and we'll figure out how to, you know, how to live our new lives.
We definitely will. And it's going to be okay. We'll get there.
Right. Listen, if you've end up, thanks for making it this far with us. And if you end up in a position that's just so drastically different and, like, completely understand how wrongheaded we are, let us know. Reach out on Instagram, which is always reliable, and Facebook, which is a little less reliable, and, you know, that's on us. But Instagram is super reliable. But, you know, shoot us a message and let us know your thoughts. And we love pushback, and we love sort of, you know, just rehashing the and being open and trying to update ideas and, you know, open to new understanding. So... that'd be amazing. If you rate us, hopefully highly on your favorite podcast platform, that would be amazing. Tell your friends. Let's get like some family and some love and some hugs going on and just all fall in. But we appreciate you listening, and Thanks for hanging out.
Yeah. See ya.